Right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Inside Writing. This show is presented by Gotham Writers Workshop, offering writing classes of all types and sizes. You can visit us at gothamwriters.com. A quick announcement, and again, I mentioned this at the top of every episode, but if you've missed any episodes of Inside Writing, you can find the recorded versions on YouTube or wherever you listen to podcasts. The same goes for this episode. It'll be available on YouTube and wherever you listen to podcasts by tomorrow. And moving into the show for today, most of you know this already, the Q&A portion of the show, you can submit your questions for the Q&A portion later on in the show using that Q&A button on your Zoom dashboard. The sooner you get in those questions, the better. Once I see a significant chunk of questions piling up, I'll cut over to audience questions. So the sooner you get them in, the sooner we can get to them. So today, we're going to be talking about flash nonfiction. As always, I'd like to start with a quote. And for the first time in the history of the show, the quote comes from one of the panelists, from Dentine Moore, who wrote, "Not all writing is political or revolutionary, but the very act of giving yourself permission to write, to speak, to share the truth, no matter whether the truth you understand is the truth others want to acknowledge, is brave, powerful, and important." We'll be talking more about that later, but let's meet our panelists. Our first panelist, author of the essay collection A Fish Growing Lungs, as well as a Pushcart nominated and award-winning writer of pieces appearing in such places as Brevity, the Southeast Review, Hobart, and more, Alicia Sao Chin. Hello, Alicia.
Hi.
Hi there. And our second panelist, the editor and creator of Brevity, author of the award-winning memoir Between Panic and Desire, and pieces appearing in the Gettysburg Review, Harper's Magazine, Crazy Horse, and more, Dentine Moore. Hello, Dentine.
Hi there.
Thank you both for being here. So the first question, we're going to start with our definition as we normally do. Dentine, I want to ask you first, in the simplest terms possible, how would you define what flash nonfiction is?
Well, it begins with word count. There's different definitions of flash. My magazine says 750 words or fewer. But the real definition has to do with compression. You take a story, an emotion, a human experience, and you just, you know, squeeze it into a small package that has, I think, sometimes incredible power because of the compression.
Mm-hmm. Alicia, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I also am a big fan of, like, let's start with the word count and then go from there. When I teach flash nonfiction, I always tell, I feel like I can talk up Brevity a lot because, you know, I'm not the editor. But so what I tell my students is, like, you know, a lot of journals will say flash is 1,000, but Brevity is 750. And a lot for a lot of people, that's kind of like the gold standard. So I always make sure to tell my students that. So 750 words or fewer. and yeah, absolutely. It's all about compression. And yeah, for me, those are like really the two big rules. And other than that, it's like you get to make cool stuff because it's such a small space.
So Alicia, since we're starting with the word count limit, I'm curious, when you begin writing a story, do you already have that word count in mind? Are you making sure you don't go over it, or is that something you cut back on?
It depends. So for example, like right now I'm working on a collection of like short pieces. So those I know I generally want to keep them pretty short. So that, you know, really reflects all parts of the, or is reflected in all parts of the writing process from like conceptualization to execution. But some pieces I just start writing and then in the revision process, it's like, oh, I think this is in fact flash and we need to like gut this bit.
So whenever you start writing, you don't necessarily think I'm going to write flash nonfiction today. You're just kind of telling a story and where it ends up is.
It depends. Yeah, it depends.
Gotcha. Dentine, the word count limit, how strict is that? Are people allowed to budge a little bit? Like, is 760? Is that like an automatic disqualification?
If I remember to check, yes. We've had two stories, and Brevity's been around for 22 years. It's quite a long haul for a journal. We've had two pieces in Brevity that were longer than 750. The first time I just missed it and found out 2 years later. The more recent one was a piece that had to do with the Transgender Day of Remembrance by Tori Peters. and it demanded a little more space. So we just sort of said, you know, rules need to be broken sometimes.
Alicia, does writing within such a specific word count, does it, you know, you've mentioned the word compression, and I want to spend some time on this. Do you feel like it makes it easier to tell a story when you're compressing it in those words, or does it make it more difficult?
Both. Both in the sense that I think that people, like readers, are more accustomed to doing some work with Flash, in that there's a lot of times like inferences that are made or things that the reader brings to the text themselves that as a writer you can kind of like gesture to or point at. But at the same time, it is hard. I think when writing Flash for me, it's always that finding that balance of like, okay, what can I gesture to? And the reader is able to like sort of arrive at least at an emotional space that I want them to, versus like, where am I just, you know, almost like a diary entry kind of, where like it means something to me, but the reader isn't able to engage with it. And I think for me, that's like the fundamental tension with writing Flash. Mm-hmm.
You touched on two things that I want to get back to later, but I want to hear Dinty real quick. Dinty, there are so many elements that go into crafting a good story. Do all Flash nonfiction pieces have to have that balance of character and plot and setting, or can you just focus on one for Flash?
You know, when I'm starting to sound like the old grandfather around the fire, but you know, when I started this journal, I was convinced that Flash had to be, you know, a pretty much distinct scene. You know, take 5 minutes out of your life that has some emotional resonance to it, and bring it to the reader and bring the reader there. And I've seen writers do so many other things with it than what I thought, you know, the limitations would be. So I'm done giving rules. You know, it has to be this, it has to be that. One rule that I stand with is that you cannot waste words. I mean, people who study poetry are going to understand this, but I think it's true of all good prose, even novels, you know, even 300-page books. Every sentence should do two or three things. It's not just giving information, or it's not just providing a bit of voice or mood. It's introducing characters. It's advancing plot. It's also giving us a bit of the author's voice. I mean, there's a different list of what those two or three things might be, but there's not time to sort of, I'm going to do this over here and then I'll get to that then. Just all got to be there. Mm-hmm. From the first sentence.
Mm-hmm. Alicia, we mentioned this balance of different story elements. How do you approach that? Are you consciously thinking, okay, I need some plot needs, or does you just go naturally wherever the story takes you?
So in the Flash pieces I've been working on most recently, they're themed. And so for me, it often starts with, I hope I'm not going to like misquote this, but I'm pretty sure this is also what like River Teeth, the journal's name comes from. But it's that idea of like the things that you like, that sort of haunt you or that you like go back to, those things that you like work over in your mind. And for me, it usually starts there. And where it goes from that moment can vary really widely. I'm a really, really slow writer, both in terms of like how much time I spend staring out the window versus moving my fingers, and in terms of how much time I take between drafts. And so for me, the first draft can look like a lot of different things, but it's in the revision process where I start to very consciously be like, okay, sentence number one, sentence number two, like how are these things working? The book I always recommend people, it's called Several Short Sentences on Writing by Verlyn Klinkenborg. I read that in grad school and it like fundamentally like changed the way that I thought about writing. And I think it's especially useful for Flash. Mm-hmm.
So Dinty, I want to talk a little bit about that quote that you mentioned, or the quote that we used from you at the top of the show. Especially because I feel like with a lot of nonfiction writers, especially writing about personal stuff, they feel like what they write about has to be like a life-changing event or a monumental happening in their life. Can any event turn into a creative piece?
Yes. I mean, if the writer is intensely curious about, let's say we're writing memoir. I mean, a lot of Flash's memoir, but not all of it. We get literary journalism, We certainly get some beautiful lyric work. But if it's memoir-based, which most of the flash we get is, you know, I think the important thing is often if it's a big event, a dramatic event, you know, my husband's yelling at me and our marriage is over, or I just learned that somebody in my family is about to die. I'm not making fun of those. Those are horrible things to happen in a life, but they don't actually make very good stories. They're too intense. Smaller moments that the writer is intensely curious about. She wants to look at it. She wants to turn it over in her hand, in her mind, and sort of write about it as a way to understand it. You know, those are much more successful than I'm going to write about the most amazing, you know, Rolling Stones concert you can ever imagine. I think drama is overrated.
I'm reminded right now of that piece in Brevity, Some Childhood Dreams Really Do Come True by Beth Ann Fennelly, that's like this many paragraphs, you know, it's like literally this big. And it's, everybody should go look it up. It's just beautiful. And it's like so concise, and it's about aging, right? Like it's about how the body changes as it ages, and that's it, you know?
So Alicia, what draws you to certain events in your life to write about? What makes you say, this is something that I need to dig into?
Well, with my first book, that was more of like a dramatic, like objectively, like kind of big tumultuous thing that had happened in my life. And I'd spent a lot of time like thinking about that and its implications and what that meant, you know, broader sense. But I mean, honestly, it's just like, I don't know why my brain chooses the things that it does sometimes and just sort of like latch onto and be like, this is the thing that you're gonna think about all the time. Yeah, I think if I knew why my brain picked things, I would bottle that somehow, but I don't have that knowledge at this time. But I like to think that like the things that I write about, that they have some like, I don't like the word universality. That might not even be a real word, but I like to think the things that I write about at their core have some sort of, like the word Dinty was just using, like emotional resonance for other people, right? It's like that same chord gets struck in the reader, whether even though the external circumstances surrounding it might be different, like at the core, it's the same. Mm-hmm.
And universality, I hope it works. It's going to come back later in this discussion. I have a question about it. But I wanted to follow up real quick with something you said. So if you're not, like, have you ever been in a moment and you're like, this is something I'm going to write about later? Like, what's your writing? Like, does the creativity hit you in the moment? Or is this something you look back on years later?
Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to be like, oh, God, yes. But like, I remember, I feel like I shouldn't say this in a recorded podcast, but that's okay. So when I was an undergrad, I remember I read an excerpt of a book, which I'm now going to leave unnamed, for a memoir class. And I remember just being really like sort of put off by it at the time, because basically the writer had been like given book money to go do a thing that they were then going to write about. And I was like, is it authentic at that point? If you're like, I don't know. Anyway, so it happened to me once, and I did actually write about it, and it was published. And I hated the fact that I was thinking about writing about it as it was happening. So basically, to keep it short, there's two pieces about it. One is called A Spell for Grief, and it's in the Indiana Review. And the other one is called, I forget, Seven Mornings, and it's published in Hobart. And it's about a friend of mine dying and like finding out that she had been in a coma. And like when I got the phone call, I was literally like moving across the country. My dad was driving the car. It was like this very tense thing. And we were like passing by a wreck that was literally on fire as my phone was ringing. And it was just like, it was too much. You know what I mean? I was like, I hate this about myself too, that impulse that I'm like, this is like perfect for writing. And I'm like, my friend is dying. Like, what is happening here? So that was maybe more of an answer than you bargained for. So no, yes, it has happened before.
I prefer answers that are more than I bargained for. Thank you. Dinty, I want to, we've touched on this a few times, but it's another, something else you mentioned in the quote that we use, which is that you're writing about a truth. What is the truth of a piece? If you had to break it down into what exactly that is.
You know, the philosophy major, are you, Josh?
I'm not.
I mean, it's, you know, people always say, I don't know if this is where you're going with this. People always ask me, well, memory is so horrible. We don't remember things correctly that happened 4 days ago, much less, you know, 14 years ago. And my answer to that is always, you know, the author has to do his or her darndest to tell the truth as best as you can uncover it. And there's ways to interrogate memory. There's ways to research memory. But sure, any piece of memoir is only the truth of the memory, not the truth of what actually happened. And I say to writers who are still confused, I say, you know when you're lying. If you're lying, if you're making something up, that's fiction, which is wonderful. But you've gone out of the realm of nonfiction. You know, nonfiction is, I've done my best to excavate that memory, and where I'm not sure, I've made it clear to the reader that I'm not sure. And often the vagaries of memory, the inexactness of memory is part of the story, and actually it can be a very interesting part of the story.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to follow up on, you mentioned when people lie, they cross into the realm of fiction. I'm curious, as the editor, how can you tell when somebody's not being completely honest in their story, or can you tell?
No. I mean, plenty of times I've suspected, sometimes I've actually contacted the author, and they've been a few times like, oh, I didn't know I couldn't do fiction. But a couple of times, which are really awkward, I've contacted the author and found out, no, it's true. But I mean, having published thousands and thousands of pieces of nonfiction in my magazine, I have to trust the authors. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I can tell when somebody's being emotionally genuine, but you can be emotionally genuine in fiction and nonfiction. Mm-hmm.
So I want to talk a bit about theme or emotional truth, or there's so many different words for it. Alicia, you mentioned that you've been writing a lot about theme lately. I'm curious. So with these stories, do you start with a theme and build a story around there?
So my current project that I'm working on is about relationships. And so there's a lot of material there. And so it's about relationships is like the sort of personal component. And then the researched component is flowers, broadly speaking. And so for me, those themes are broad enough, but you know, I still have a lot to choose from. And it's only like later as I start to like piece them together that I start to worry more about the specific cohesiveness and like how they would interweave in like a collection. There have been a couple though, like for example, so submitting Flash is kind of a weird, especially micro. I think Flash not so much, but like when you get into like micro territory, micro is especially, for me at least, tricky to navigate that idea of like, okay, what is this micro without all the other micros around it? And so thinking about when putting together like a submission package for a literary magazine, like what are, you know, three pieces that sort of speak to one another as well. But yeah, for me, like the finer grain theming comes later in the process. When I write, it's in the like really big categories where I could be writing about a lot of things.
And Dinty, are you actively looking for themes in a piece? Do you have to see one?
I hate the word theme, to be honest with you. It takes me back to high school and man versus man versus the environment, man versus religion, as if the author sits down, as Herman Melville sits down and decides on his theme before he even starts exploring Moby Dick. I think that you discover the meaning in a piece as you're writing it. And for me, it's not even the first couple of drafts. The first couple of drafts are me just flailing around out there trying to find a sentence that comes alive for me. So I'm going to, you know, I'll just say, I'll ask Alicia, you know, is relationships and flowers a theme, or is it more of a question? Like, learn about relationships by thinking about flowers? And what can I learn about flowers by taking flowers and relationships and rubbing them up against one another? Because I believe much more firmly in questions rather than themes.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's definitely a question. And like part of the question, I think, is like, and this is always sort of my question when I'm writing, is like, why are these two things like this for me in my mind? You know, like, right? And there's like the obvious, like, oh, flowers die, like relation, right? But like, that's not interesting. Like, you have to do the like digging in there. I think about like the intro, it might not be the intro, but like the beginning section of Between Panic and Desire, right? And your narrator is like driving and is between these two points. And there's just like this wonderful moment where it's like, I have been here all my life. And I think about that, right? And like, I imagine that like that wasn't, you didn't start the book there, writing the book there. You know what I mean? Like that comes later when you have everything and you've started to like make meaning out of, okay, here are all the things that have been like bouncing around in my brain. What is connecting them?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, by the way, but yes, that's exactly how it happened.
So I want to get back to something. I think both of you made mention to this before, but Alicia, I want to start with you. Do all flash nonfiction pieces, do they focus on a single event, or can you cover a broad swath of time just condensed into a smaller piece?
I think I've definitely seen some really great pieces cover broad swaths of time. And you know, it's like, what is the connective tissue that's connecting those events, right? And there's, I'm trying to think of like a good example off the top of my head that covers a large span of time, and I can't, but I know I've seen them.
I'll look them up now.
Yeah, I was going to say like, oh, my brain. Or here's one, which I actually do not know how long the span of time this covers, but The Heart is a Torn Muscle by Randon Billings Noble is about like an emotional relationship with someone who is not her husband. I don't even know if relationship is the right word, but an emotional response to somebody who is not her like primary partner. And she doesn't ever specifically say how long of a period of time this occurs for, but the duration is clearly not like a scene. No.
Gotcha. Denti, what about you?
I referenced this earlier. I would have 18 years ago answered your question. Yes, it has to be a distinct, you know, short, and then I've seen people cover 40 years of their life in 600 words, and it works somehow. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of it's metaphor and detail at that point. You know, you have less time for plot, and image or metaphor do a lot of, like poetry, image and metaphor can do a lot of work in a short piece of prose. Mm-hmm.
So this is a technical question. It always comes up during nonfiction, so I'll just go ahead and ask it. Alicia, how do you write about other people in nonfiction? Do you concern yourself with how other people might be portrayed, or do you just kind of write it as honestly as you can?
Depends on the draft. I start with, you know, what I think. And then later, as it gets closer to, I don't know, publication or revision or thinking about publication, that's when on a case-by-case basis, I'll take it. So just to give some like concrete examples, my book that came out in June, like some people I specifically interviewed for the piece. And so they knew from the get-go. Some people, I sent them a copy of the book and was like, hey, just so you know, this is coming out. You can read it. Some people I didn't say anything, and who knows if they know. But I try to be careful about what I write about other people, in the sense that, like, if you were already in my life at the time that something happened, you might be able to identify them, but you wouldn't be able to like Google me. You know what I mean? If you're like a stranger, you wouldn't be able to go up to another stranger and be like, you're the person that this thing is about. I also try not to write about other people's trauma, especially if it doesn't impact me directly. Like, things between me and one other person are generally fair game, but things that are like in another person's past or whatever, I try to be a little more discreet about. Mm-hmm.
Dinty, what about you? Any advice or tips to people that are worried about how others will be portrayed in their stories?
Don't worry about it while you're writing. Or it'll just choke you off at the source. And you write it as honestly as you can. And then you can decide when it's all done. I'm going to publish this after my Aunt Katie dies. I'm never going to publish this, but I needed to write it. But having those voices in your head as you're writing, oh my God, my sister's going to be so ticked off at me. I better not say this. I better not say that. That's just going to smother a piece. Mm-hmm. I'm like Alicia. I'm careful. I don't tend to show my work to other people. It's up to me to be honest and ethical. I write a lot about my parents who were very troubled. They're my parents. I don't feel like I have to hold back. It's my life. If I'm writing about people I tangentially know, I try really hard to hold myself to, like, is that fair? Is that fair to say that? Mm-hmm. But it's my opinion, you know, in the end, it's my way of viewing the world. I'm not claiming to be the perfect source.
So you both touched on the revision process. I want to get into that now as well, because Alicia, I'll start with you here. You mentioned how, you know, especially in Flash, every single sentence has to pull its weight. And it's in the revision process that you really go back and start fine tuning. What's your revision process like? Are you going line by line, or how do you go about approaching a piece that you want to move forward through editing?
With Flash, I mean, in general, I'm a line by line type of person, but with Flash particularly so. Recently, I actually did have the experience where I ended up combining a number of pieces that were separate, but I was like, oh, these actually go together, and they sort of build more of an arc when they're put next to each other. And then there's the patterning, right? So like, okay, this image appears here. How do we see this image? Can we see this image again later and see it in a new way? Things of that nature. And, you know, the gesture is so important, I think, you know, or like all the implications or connotations a word has is so important. And so it really might be like, okay, this piece is 500 words. I have spent 4 hours looking at 500 words and like three words have changed. And it's just like, that's part of the process, I think. And if one thing has changed, one thing has changed between when I first started writing and now, it's that like my patience for my own revision process has increased, which I am immensely grateful for.
Dinty, what about you? Both your editing process for your own writing, and what's some stuff you encourage writers to do to help build a piece and get it stronger after that first draft?
Just want to get that out there. I'm not the first person to say this, obviously. Write very messy first drafts. Make it big a mess as you can, because you don't even know what you're writing about at that stage, and you want to surprise yourself, and suddenly you're writing a sentence or an idea and you go, oh my goodness, I didn't even know I thought that. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. But my middle stage revision process is like that stupid scene in so many comedies where the husband goes into the kitchen to make scrambled eggs and you know, and then suddenly every dish is dirty and every greasy, and there's flour on the walls and the dog is eating, you know, something off the floor. It's a very messy process for me. And then as I get near the end, and I'm a bear, I revise a piece 60, 70, 80 times. When I get close to the end, then it's like really gotta get this room in order and make it neat and clean and pristine. And I'm reading every sentence out loud to myself. Mm. Both does it sound good? Does it sound good, but doesn't mean anything? It just sounds good. Does it sound good, and do I believe it? And then finally, it's just like my ear can pick things up that my brain misses, because my brain is trying too hard to make sense of things, but. In the end, I trust listening. I read out, in other words, I read it out loud to myself in these final stages of revision.
Did you once, I feel like you once told me, Dinty, that you delete your older drafts. Is that true?
Yeah, I don't know why people are so amazed by that, because I just naturally, when I'm on draft 16, draft 15 is deleted. When I'm on draft 17, you know, people say, I have 40 drafts of this on my hard drive in case I want to go back.
Final for real.
Because I want to go back and get something that was better. And I'm like, no, it's just an act of faith. Even if my 10th draft screws everything up and my 8th draft was better, mm-hmm. I need to just go forward and draft 12 is going to be even better.
You have like a radical faith in the process.
Yeah. So what, I mean, yeah, I do. And I'm a part of it is just trying to support myself, sort of say, come on, Dinty, you can do this. I believe in you. Because it's hard. I don't always believe in me.
Well, for what it's worth, Dinty, I do the same thing. My drafts don't live on past that editing stage, but I want to, you touched on something that transitions into, I want to start talking about publishing / nonfiction and how people can move towards that. So this is a question I always ask, and I know there's not one clear-cut answer, but I just want to hear what both of you have to say about it. Dinty, I'll start with you. How do you know when a piece is ready to be submitted? How do you know that draft was the last one?
Whether it's a flash piece or a 300-page book, if I can read it from the beginning to the end out loud to myself and I don't stumble on a sentence and go, oh, that's awkward. If it just reads well, if I hear it sounding complete, then that's how I know.
What about you, Alicia?
Yeah, actually mine's the same as I read aloud when it comes to like the final pass through. And that's also my like final test.
Gotcha. So Alicia, how do you know if a literary magazine is right for your piece? Whenever you look at a place, how do you say this is where it's going to go?
You got to read it consistently. yeah, that's like far and away the number one sort of thing. And it just like, it just takes time. There are a lot of literary journals that exist in the world. There are a few, you know, websites that sort of like curate lists off the top of my head, like Entropy, Clifford Garstang, and then I know specifically Brevity just put together like a list of journals that publish flash nonfiction. But yeah, you just gotta like read and find, because, you know, having also worked as a literary magazine editor, like there have definitely been pieces that I've enjoyed like as a reader, but like it's not a good fit for the journal either at this time, legitimately, right? It's not like it's not you, it's me. They like really mean it. So yeah, you just gotta read a lot. And then still you have to get lucky, right? On top of everything else, I definitely believe that like publishing involves more than a modicum of luck. Mm-hmm.
Dinty, what I know that every literary magazine has its what we're looking for, but if you had to condense Brevity's what we're looking for, what is it exactly that Brevity's looking for?
I think all of the above that everybody says, we want a good story, we want lovely sentences, we want beautiful detail and image. To me, I want to feel a voice behind it. If Alicia sends us a piece about flowers and relationships, I want to feel like nobody else would have said it exactly that same way. Nobody else would have told it exactly that same way. I mean, that's why we're artists, or that's what artists do, is we walk through the world and we see things and different things catch our attention. So the way a writer sees the world and then the way the writer talks about it, I think that both of those are part of voice. So I want to feel that this is a story that only Josh, not that only Josh could have told, but only Josh would have told it this way. Mm-hmm. Only Alicia would have told it this way. Mm-hmm. I get a lot of good writing that's kind of generic. It's like, that's really good writing. And I've seen it, you know, every couple of months, that same piece of writing. And it's solid, but it doesn't feel human.
Mm-hmm. Dinty, do you recommend that writers, should they be thinking about where to send a piece before they're ready to send it? Is that something they could be thinking about while they're writing?
Either or. I've done both. I know other writers who do both. Sometimes I get hold of something, I just have to write about it because it's caught, it's got me. And it's fun. I've also been there, but I have a lot of writer friends at this point in my life, and they're like, I wrote this thing and I have no idea what to do with it now. But, and then sometimes I've thought, you know, this is, I really like that journal. And I noticed that that journal has a certain kind of energy to it. And I think I'm going to shoot myself in that direction. So I've done it both ways. And I think I would recommend, you know, don't limit yourself to one or the other.
Mm-hmm. Alicia, what about you? At what point, I'm sure it's different for each time, but when do you start thinking about when to send a piece, or where to send a piece, I should say?
Yeah, it's the same for me. It really depends. Like sometimes I'm writing because I want to write the thing. And then sometimes there's some journals that I'm like, yeah, you know, I really like what they write. But you only know that if you read them a lot. So that's where it starts.
And Alicia, you know, sometimes it takes a while to hear back on submissions. What are you doing in the meantime? How do you keep your mind occupied so you're not just laboring over your submissions window?
Oh, like just refreshing and submittable. Yes. And waiting for it to, yeah. I think like working at Lit Mags has helped me so much as a writer in many, many ways. But one of the things is just like, I'm a lot more chill than I used to be about that refresh button. But I mean, I'm always working on something or reading something, or, you know, like I'm not a one project at a time person. I never have been. So yeah, it's like, okay, not going to think about that now. And then I don't think about it until it comes back, you know, and then we deal with it then.
Dinty, what's the process like at Brevity when a submission comes in? Do you see everything that comes in? Do you have readers that pick their favorites, or how does it work?
It used to be just me. We used to get, you know, 10 submissions a month. We're getting 600 to 800 submissions a month at this point. So it's not just me anymore. So I have a staff of volunteer submission readers who are wonderful. And for each submission that comes in, a couple of them, and it was not, no one person makes the first decision. So three people will look at a submission. If all three say no, that's probably it for that submission. If there's a mixed opinion, then some more people look at it. And, you know, then if six or seven people have looked at it and enough of them like it, then it gets the maybe label put on it. And eventually it comes to my desk. So I don't see everything anymore. It's just not humanly possible. Right. I see the ones that some other people have said, you know, we should think about this one. It's a good maybe. And every once in a while I get an email from somebody saying, this came in yesterday, it's amazing, please go look at it before some other journal takes it.
Gotcha. And another part of publishing, unfortunately, is the rejection side of things. So I don't want to spend too much time here, but Alicia, how do you stay positive in rejections? What? How do you learn from your rejections, especially if they're form rejections? What do you take away from them?
Two things I would say. Thing one is, I mentioned earlier that like I do firmly believe that like getting published there's luck involved. And so I like to think that keeps me like right-sized when I am getting published, but it also helps me like not crumble into a pit of despair when I'm not getting published. So that's thing number one, is just like a lot of it's not about me necessarily. But the other thing too is like, you know, I've kept track of my, you know, submissions since I started submitting, and I know other writers as well. And like, just because one journal says no, that doesn't mean, for me at least, that it needs to get scrapped or like revised yet, right? Like I tier my submissions generally, and we'll send it out in batches. And so I have to get a number, because the process before I submit work is so, I don't want to say rigorous, but like long, you know? And because I know that journals only have space for X number of things, like whatever, all these factors, I'll submit something a number of times before I go back to the drawing board and look at the piece again. Not even drawing board, but the revision board.
And Dinty, from the editorial side, is there anything, any like recurring things that you see that are like automatic rejection, any red flags that you see that can just tell you that this piece is not ready? Or basically, when you reject someone, what are some of the main reasons why you're going to reject them?
I call it clearing the throat. The first three or four sentences are the writer sort of trying to figure out where they want the piece to start, which I do. And then in revision, I get rid of those sentences. But if that sort of clearing of the throat or spinning the tires in the sand is in the first three or four sentences, that's a big no. Mm-hmm. Just wordiness generally, because we're a flash magazine, is a big no. And this oddly enough, you'd think with all of the talk in the world about the importance of understanding the complexity of race and gender and ethnicity and sexuality and all of the things, we still get some pretty stupid pieces from people who like haven't gotten the memo. Mm-hmm. That this is a new world, and thank God that it is. So we don't like racism, we don't like sexism, we don't like homophobia. We're kind of against those things. So send those someplace else.
Gotcha. And when it comes to personal rejections, I know some people often say, you know, form rejections are really hard to stay positive through, but form or personal rejections, they're different. So from your point of view, when you're sending a personal rejection, how close was that piece to making it? And do you think that, I mean, obviously it's not going to be the same across the board, but what goes into a personal rejection for you?
If a piece did get close, and we don't have a lot of time, just because I'm not paid for what I do. This is something I do out of love and service. I have other ways, other things I have to do so that I can put food on the table. So we don't have a lot of time to edit and revise and work with writers. We do that sometimes, but not very often. So, but if a piece is close, and I look at the notes that some of the other people who've read it have, and they're consistent, I'll send that along. We really like this piece, but in the end, we thought, no, here's a thought about what might not be working. Mm-hmm. And then I have a couple of really close friends that I have to turn down every once in a while, which is painful. So I send them a note and say, oh God, I still love you, but we got so much good work and we can't publish this one. Mm-hmm. I do that to Alicia every couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Just quit sending us all your junk, Alicia.
I know. That's what helps me stay, I'm like, oh, it's just, they don't have space for me this time. It's fine.
So I have so many more questions, but we're going to get into audience Q&A. A real quick note. If you had any questions about, essays or works that either of the two panelists have mentioned, I will include those in the show note after, or in the show notes afterwards. I'll email all the links to you. So I'm not going to ask them those questions, but I will get those for after the show. So first question, this is a good question. It ties into, we just had the Flash Fiction episode 2 weeks ago, and one of the big things we talked about was endings and how important it is to have closure, or if you can end on cliffhangers. And I'm seeing a few questions that deal with that. So Alicia, I'll start with you. How do you approach the ending of a piece? Do you always look for closure, or can you leave it open ending with a cliffhanger?
Closure, smosure. No, I'm kidding. For me, it's less about closure and more about an emotional change. So like I have to feel differently at the end of the piece, or the reader has to feel differently at the end of the piece than they did in the beginning. And like sometimes that feeling at the end is they are more troubled than they were when they started. So it doesn't, no bows here. I also don't, I'm not a bow fan.
Yeah. I mean, real briefly, I'd say don't tell me what to think at the end of a piece. Give me something to think about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like that. Denti, let's start with you on this one. Do you think that writing Flash helps improve people's writing in other things that aren't Flash, like writing a book?
Absolutely. The sort of multi-purpose sentence, the importance of letting an image tell the story or a metaphor tell the story, just the concision of writing elegant sentences. You take that into your longer work and, oh wow, suddenly your longer work is better. And of course, and sometimes I pick up a book by someone who is an amazing writer, and I think, wow, this person is writing 300 pages of Flash because everything is so tight and everything is so beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Next question. I'll start with, we'll start with Alicia for this one. Since there's so limited space in Flash nonfiction, how do you go about conveying important backstory? Is there a way for you to do that quickly, or do you just, or how do you approach it?
I feel like I keep using this word gesture, but that really, you know, it's like implication, not particulars. I also am a giant fan of exposition. I feel like that's like part of what like drove me to the world of nonfiction in the first place. And so I'm a big fan of like the one perfect sentence that like gives you, you know, 5 years of emotional meaning. I think, and we were talking too about like the emotional resonance of a piece, right? And so it's like, okay, so how do you, it's not that the particulars aren't important, because the particulars are important, but it's like you need to make like space for the reader to also have that connection with your story. And if you get so bogged down and like, you need to know exactly, it's like you're controlling what you're, I'm trying to think of an articulate way to say this. It's like what Dindy said about don't tell me what to think. I think when a writer or when I am like getting really hung up on like backstory or particulars or something, it's because I'm very concerned with how the reader is going to think about the piece. And I want them to think a certain thing. And then I have an agenda of some kind. And that's where I start to get into trouble. And so when I think more expansively about like, okay, so here's gesture or like an idea or something of that nature, I feel like I'm starting to get a little vague, but that is better often.
Mm-hmm. Dinty, what about you? Have you seen any good uses of backstory? Does it have a place? How do you?
Yeah, it has a place. I would say I'm going to make a proclamation here, and proclamations are always, you know, specious. If you're a beginning writer, really ask yourself if the backstory is necessary. 80% of the time it isn't, but 20% of the time it is. So just, I mean, if you're going to put backstory in, just make sure you ask yourself at some point, do I really need that? Because more often than not, you don't. But if you do, the simplest way to handle it, it's the simplest way to handle it. You know, just write a sentence that says, my wife, you know, died 3 years earlier.
Mm-hmm. So next question, Dinty, we've talked about what's too long for flash fiction. Is anything too short for flash fiction or flash nonfiction? I'm sorry.
Yeah. We've published pieces of less than 100 words. I don't think, I'm willing to believe anything is possible. I haven't seen anything shorter than 60 or 70 words that have done it yet, but if it shows up, we're happy to publish it. Mm-hmm.
Alicia, I'll start with you on this next one. Do you have a practice you do before you begin your writing?
I should. Like when I'm in a good space, I do. Checking Twitter and then checking Instagram. No, that's like a little too honest, honestly. That was like a little too honest. I write best when I am undisturbed, alone. My back is literally against a wall. I don't really, generally speaking, when I wake up in the morning, I meditate and do some sort of like physical practice, sometimes yoga, sometimes I go for a run, what have you. And in my ideal world, that is immediately followed by like a shower, breakfast, and writing. Most of the time these days, that is not how I'm able to like structure my life. And so as long as I have like a quiet space where like literally I don't feel like anyone's like looking over my shoulder at the crappy stuff I'm like scrawling in my notebook, you know, that's all I need really.
Mm-hmm. It's important to me to get at least 10 minutes of self-loathing.
Of course. Thank you. I forgot about that.
Yeah. Oh my God, I'm an idiot. I can't write. My sentences are so dull. Yes. My ideas are stupid. I let that go for a while. Then I dive in.
So other than the self-loathing, do you have any other things you do beforehand, Dinty?
No, that's about it.
Gotcha. I mean,
really honest to God, it's like, it's so hard to write that my just get my, I'm talking to myself now, just get your damn fingers on that keyboard and put some words on the page, because they're going to be the wrong words and you have to get them out of the way so you can get to the right words.
Yeah.
Dinty, I want to start this next question with you because you mentioned how many drafts you go through. So the question is, when you reread your drafts so many times, do you ever get bored with the final draft? And if so, how do you differentiate between being overexposed versus spotting something that needs to be revised?
Ooh, that's tough. That's tough. There's a lot of mental tricks that I've taught myself over the years. One of them is reading it like it's the first time you've read it. It's kind of like you kind of psych yourself out. The other one is to read it as if you don't know what's going to happen. Read it as if you're somebody else. I wish I could tell people easily how to get there, but like anything, it's just a matter of like trying, practicing, kind of getting a little bit better at it and getting a little bit better at it. So, you know, there's always a stage where I am able to read something I've written and been working on for months or years and say, okay, I didn't write this. I don't know anything. And I sort of go sentence to sentence. What does the reader know now? What does the reader not know now? What is the reader curious about now? More to the point of the question, yes, there are points that I get really bored and think I've been doing this project for so long. I can't even differentiate between what I'm tired of because I know it too well and what's dull. I think you just have to wait those moments out. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's a lot of writing, and I make the self-loathing jokes because there, you know, there is writer's block and there is doubt. And if anything I've done right over the last many, 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 many years of being a writer, it's like I've learned to wait those bad periods out, and then the good ones will come back.
Mm-hmm. Alicia, what about you during the revision period? How do you know if you're just bored with the piece versus it actually does need revision?
Yeah, I mentioned earlier that I'm a really slow writer, and part of that is that I literally have to like step away from a draft for a long period of time in between, which is part of why I work on so many things at once, is because I have a hard time differentiating. So like, you know, just being able to like put down something and not touch it again for several months at a time is like really valuable for me, just because then like I'll be like, did I write that? Oh, that's good. Or like, oh, you know, and I do get some of that like distance, like, you know, it's like turning yourself into a character when you're writing nonfiction. It's like this, I feel like I have that like a schema already in my head of like how to do that for me. So then I just try to do it for my writing.
So next question, and it's funny because I never got to my question on universality, but it's fate because somebody in the audience asked about universality. So I'm going to ask it. It's a general question, but Dinty, you mentioned generic writing. They asked if you could speak more about universality versus generic writing. Does a piece need universality, and how does that differ from generic writing? So kind of an open-ended question
here. Yeah, I mean, I would never use the term universality, though I know what it means. It's really, it's too abstract. Mm-hmm. If you as the writer are feeling emotional movement as you're writing it and revising it, and you can put that emotional movement onto the page, the reader's going to feel it. Mm-hmm. We all, you know, we're real close, whether, you know, we have the same insecurities, the same aspirations, the same deep worries, the same pain across the human species and maybe even beyond. So that's just tell a true story with your heart wide open, and it's going to have universality. And thank you everyone for not using the word relatable. but that's what's relatable, is you're telling a true story and you're emotionally honest, and Josh and Alicia read it and they go, yeah, I know how that feels.
Mm-hmm. So kind of a follow-up to that, but this idea of generic writing, how does a piece feel generic? Are there giveaways that, oh, you've seen this before?
That's a hard one. It's just making these moves on the page that don't feel heartfelt. Like, okay, I'm going to put this in, and I'm going to put this in, and I'm going to put this in, because I've seen Cheryl Strayed do that. I've seen You know, Mary Carr do that. I've seen Bill Werbach do that. And it's like, okay, but that's it's not color by numbers. It's art, you know, and art takes risk and emotion. Mm-hmm.
Alicia, this question is for you. You've mentioned the word gesture a few times, and somebody asked, what do you mean exactly by gesture? So the simplest way possible, how would you define what you mean by gesture?
Yeah. you know what, I'm just gonna talk about a piece of my own that was published in Brevity, just because I can speak like concretely to that. And I'm gonna pull it up on my computer so that I don't like, you know, ruin something. Okay. So there's a piece in Brevity that was published by me. That was not a correct sentence, but anyway, it was published in September of 2018. So looking at like the first paragraph of it, when I was 17, I spent a lot of time in another family's home. And then it goes into some descriptors of the other family's home. And from those descriptors, like you get an image in your mind, not just of what the room looked like, but hopefully like some things about that family as well, some things about my family, things of that nature. I don't sit there and list out all the details, like they were from here and this was their address and we did these things. It's like I'm using an image to point you toward, to gesture toward more information. I hope that was an appropriate answer to the question.
Absolutely. So since we're running out of time, I just want to get my last two closing questions in. So I'm going to ask you both for a couple recommendations and then for parting advice. But let's start with the recommendations. Denti, either writers or specific pieces that you think that all flash nonfiction writers should read?
Brian Doyle. Diane Seuss. Now, Diane Seuss is a poet. Her poems are wonderful. She's a Pulitzer Prize finalist, but she's done amazing flash work too. No relation, but her last name is spelled like Dr. Seuss. Rebecca McClanahan, Jill Talbot, T-A-L-B-O-T. I'll stop. Iris Krungrung. And I'll let you figure out how to spell that.
All right. Alicia, how about you?
I'm going to start by saying, like, read the entire Brevity archive. They're online. They're free. It's like 20 years of, like, excellent creative nonfiction. It's such a wonderful resource. Yeah. And I was about to say, they now have an anthology, The Best of Brevity, which would make an excellent gift. Yeah. So Brevity, for sure. Absolutely. In terms of individual authors, in addition to who Dinty's just said, I think Abigail Thomas is one that I think about a lot. Sarah Manguso is another. And I have recently been reading Ross Gay's The Book of Delights. And he's, you know, a poet. I don't want to say a poet first, but, you know, I think he published much poetry before this book. And so I'm enjoying that quite a bit as well.
So then last question before we wrap up here is, if you could give one piece of advice to flash nonfiction writers, what would it be? Alicia, let's start with you on this one.
Genre-specific flash nonfiction writers? I mean, I think if I had to give one piece of advice to writers in general, it's just like, you know, writing is hard. You just have to like sit down and have it suck sometimes, you know, and then sometimes it's great and then it sucks again and then it's great. But if you don't do it, it'll never get done, which, you know, I wish there was some magic trick, but it's really just sitting down and doing it again and doing it better. Mm-hmm.
Denti, how about you?
Kind of turning it around, I just say that the wonderful thing about writing flash nonfiction is, you know, you're going to make mistakes as a writer. I was about to say if you're a early on writer, but no matter what stage you're in, you're going to make a lot of mistakes. So better to write six things and two of them work and four of them don't, or three of them work and three of them, as Alicia said, suck. than to work for 5 years on a book and then realize at the end, oh, that book, I had a bad idea and I didn't really. So it's a great petri dish. You can try. The great thing about flash fiction or nonfiction is you can just try so many things. And if it doesn't work well, you know, if you're 4 or 5 drafts into it and you realize that that's not going to work, you haven't put quite as much work in as if you're as if you've been working on a book for 3 years and then suddenly say, I don't even know how to write this book. So experiment.
Gotcha. Last thing, Alicia, a lot of people have asked what that the essay you mentioned at the beginning about aging was.
Some Childhood Dreams Really Do Come True by Beth Ann Fennelly, published in Brevity and also in her collection Heating and Cooling. Also, I think my other piece of advice, sorry, is just like read a lot, you know, like I think that's really important. Like you can't, I don't know, I can't write if I don't know what already exists in the world. So.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. As a reminder to everyone here, this episode will be available by tomorrow morning. If you have any questions about the episode, I am josh@gothamwriters.com. I will include show notes with links to stuff that has been mentioned, including that essay that Alicia just mentioned again, and to other references that they made. Dinty, Alicia, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. It's good to see you both.
You too. And next week, we're going to be back with Inside Genre Fiction Part 2. Same time, same place, Wednesday at 1 o'clock. We will see you then. Have a good one, everyone.